Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. I'm assuming most of you, take it for granted, most of you are aware of the recent U.S. bombing attack on a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, where there may be as many as close to 50 killed, and including patients and staff of the hospital and some children, and more than 40 wounded. Some of the wounded and some of the killed might have been Taliban fighters who were being treated and Afghani forces that were being treated in the hospital at the time. But at least 12 staff members and maybe up to 20 have been killed. This is one of a string of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of the United States. What they call collateral damage, but either mistaken or insensitively deliberate attacks on or near civilians in Afghanistan since the United States invaded, which is now, what, 13 years ago? Something like that. And this one was, I can't say it's the most egregious. Anybody lost their lives, it's egregious. The United States has bombed wedding processions, funerals, meetings in villages where people were sitting around in circles. They've killed by artillery or bombing children out gathering firewood. There have been thousands of people who have been killed as a result, directly or indirectly, of the United States military. And we I mean, I don't know when this is all supposed to stop, but the United States is not even supposed to be there now, or hardly at all, and yet we still seem to be very much there, and may even increase our presence there. There's just no end to this. I was hoping that we could get a couple of guests to talk about this today, and one of our guests, do we have him on the line? Is Michael McPherson, who is from an organization called Veterans for Peace. Hi, you there?
Yes. Hey, how are you doing today?
Okay. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I know Veterans for Peace is very much concerned with these kinds of things and has been for a long, long time. And you recently issued a press release. What can you tell us what Veterans for Peace is, what kind of organization it is?
Sure. Veterans for Peace is a group of veterans, military veterans, who have come to the conclusion that war does not solve problems. In fact, it creates more problems than it solves. And the people who are sent to fight the wars really have the least to gain from them and sacrifice the most, and the people who send us to fight gain the most from these wars. Mm-hmm. We were started in 1985, so this year is our 30th anniversary. And the reason we were started primarily is because of a number of Vietnam veterans were concerned in 1985 about U.S. intervention in Central and Latin America and the nuclear arms race.
And what's your title at the organization?
I'm the National Executive Director. We have about 110 chapters across the country, about 3,500 members. We also have associate members, friends and family, people who agree with our statement of purpose. But about 80% of our membership are veterans, and we're veteran-organized and veteran-led.
And how are you funded?
Primarily by our members, who are very dedicated. And, you know, as many of our members are combat veterans, but as veterans who have participated in the war machine, many of us, I would say most of us, feel like this is a way to try to find some level of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. So our members are very much dedicated to our organization, and even when we had the downturn in the economy, Veterans for Peace was able to continue to do pretty well. You know, we had some reduction in our funds, but mostly we did pretty well. So it's our wonderful members.
Does the organization include active duty servicemen and women?
Yes, we don't have a lot of active duty members, and you know, I think some of that is because you could maybe get in trouble if, you know, or at least be looked at a certain way, and you have to have and you have to keep a certain mindset when you're on active duty. But we do have a number of active duty members, and some people join us as they're going through a process of conscientious objection. Mm-hmm. Because we support, of course, when you decide this is not right for me, I don't want to do this anymore, we definitely support that. So we do have some.
Well, do you have attorneys you can go to help people out if they need that?
No, we don't really provide that service. We just try to provide the support, mm-hmm. you know, try to keep people's spirits up. And, you know, there's a number of organizations who really do that a lot better than us, so we have relationships with them. I should also mention that Iraq Veterans Against the War, that was started in 2004, mm-hmm. I believe, we were their fiscal sponsor. We helped them get off the ground. They were their first meeting was at our convention in Boston in 2004. So we have deep relationship with Iraq Veterans Against the War, as well as Military Families Speak Out.
Now, there's the usual, of course, there are the usual immediate promise of investigations by the Defense Department, by who knows who, you know, the usual. And we've seen that these things usually nothing ever really much comes of these things. Maybe we could go into the details if people don't, about what happened in Kunduz, which is a city in northern Afghanistan, correct?
Yes, I believe so.
And the city was in the hands of the American protected or advised Afghani forces, and I guess whatever you can call the Afghan government. I don't know exactly what that is beyond Kabul, but anyhow. But recently, the Taliban entered the city. It's like about a week and a half to 2 weeks ago. They entered the city, took it back, and then so there's a then there was a counterattack to try to take it back from them. And what happened during the midst of all this is that an American, I think it's a C-130, does it make any difference, gunship, an American plane. I guess is it an Air Force or an Army plane? I don't know.
Well, I know the Army does have the C-130 gunships, so I'm not sure if it was the Air Force's or the Army's. I need to find that out, but both of them do have that asset, I believe. I know the Army did.
So the one of these gunships attacked a Doctors Without Borders, and I guess most people know Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières in French, they've been working all over the world, and regardless of, they don't take sides on anything. They just treat people, civilians and fighters on both sides of any conflict, and they had a hospital, in fact, one of the only hospitals within any distance at all of this city of Kunduz, where they treated serious, trauma, and they, it was the only city around for like 200 miles or something like that, and the only hospital around for 200 miles. And this hospital was attacked about a week or more ago, and many people on the staff were killed. And what happened was that certain parts of the hospital seemed to have almost been deliberately targeted, like the operating room, emergency room, places where there would be likely to be the most patients, storerooms and other things seem to have escaped. They're still finding people who were buried in, in the debris.
Yeah.
And it was an incredible, astounding disaster. And what's coming out on this, the details are coming out, is that first thing the Army did, I guess, was to say that, well, the Taliban was using the hospital as a shield and shooting at American troops in the area. And so somebody called in one of these planes. But we're learning more and more of, that that's probably not what happened. Do you want to comment on the details here?
Yeah, well, everything I think you said is correct. And I think the biggest question is that the U.S. military is claiming that there was a reason as to why this area was targeted. But the Doctors Without Borders have made it a real serious policy that they make sure that they maintain that their facilities are not used by either side, for combat purposes. And in fact, when you look at the rules of engagement or rules, international rules when it comes to war, that if a hospital cannot be targeted, unless it is being used by one or the other of the side to cause harm, and if it is targeted, from my understanding, the U.S. or whoever's targeting the facility has to warn the hospital that this is about to happen. So from Doctors Without Borders' perspective, there was no firing or Taliban or anybody in their facility, and they definitely were not warned that they were about to be attacked. So the lack of warning could actually, not even the intentionality of it, but the lack of warning could make this be a war crime.
They did say that they also, just an extension of what you're saying, they said they have a policy that no one is allowed to bring any weapons.
That's right.
Into the hospital.
Right.
And
that.
They verify that nobody here, Taliban or anybody, brought any weapons into the hospital. And they were treating civilians, and they were treating fighters on both sides, because that's their mission in the world, is to go wherever people need them, regardless of not taking sides. Somebody was either sort of lost their minds, or somebody made a terrible mistake. What's even more egregious in this case is, according to Doctors Without Borders, that the attack went on for an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Five separate passes of this ship went on. It's an hour and 15 minutes of this airplane. And furthermore, that Doctors Without Borders claims that finally, when they got in touch with the authorities in Kabul, the U.S. military authorities and the Afghan authorities, for half an hour after that, there was at least one, if not two more, attacks on the hospital. And clearly, somebody either lost their minds or there was a terrible mistake made. And what do you think? To me, it's clearly a war crime. But what do you think is might come of it? Who's looking into it? And what might come of it?
Yeah. So let me say, you know, at this point, Veterans for Peace and pretty much trying to follow the lead of Doctors Without Borders, who has said that it's an attack on the Geneva Convention. But I don't think they've come right out and said that this was done, that they know for sure it was done intentionally. Mm-hmm. So we're holding back on saying that. However, you know, we have a number of service members, and including myself. I was a field artillery officer in the Army. And with field artillery, you know, the whole purpose of it is to target enemy positions for destruction. And when you do that, you have an array of maps, and you have places that you know you're not supposed to fire on. You plot those on your maps before the battle or during the battle or whatever. And we also know in this situation that Doctors Without Borders had given the commanders of U.S. forces or coalition forces their position, and it's not like their hospital was moving around, and they had GPS positions, which make it very accurate. So you have to wonder, how is it that this could be a mistake? Mm-hmm. If they actually believe there was Taliban there that were firing on forces, yet they still did not inform the hospital that they were going to attack it. So, you know, if you knew that was a hospital and you attacked it, and you thought that there were firing coming from it, enemy was there firing on you, but you didn't let the hospital know. See, so it's problematic on many levels.
Yeah.
So it's real hard to believe that this was just some kind of mistake. And then you ask, go ahead, Glenn.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I just want to re-identify. You're listening to Michael McPherson, who is executive director, is it?
Yes.
Executive director of Veterans for Peace, an organization in the United States, which is self-explanatory. And you have a website, which is what?
VeteransForPeace.org, just like it sounds, spelled out, Veterans for Peace, the word F-O-R for peace.
Now, in your press release, you said nothing, I don't know if I'm quoting this directly, but nothing good has come of the U.S. invasion and occupation. So that's one question. So as far as you're concerned, nothing good has come of the U.S. invasion and occupation, nothing good at all. And the other question attached to that is, two questions. Why were we there in the first place? Does anybody remember anymore? And I think some of us do. Maybe.
Yeah.
And why are we still there after all this time?
Yeah, that's what we wonder as well. I mean, you know, so I'll say, when we say nothing good, I think whatever good has come from it, like, for example, forcing leadership in Afghanistan to have more respect for human rights, and specifically the rights of women, that's been offset by the conditions that have been created by this war that's been going on now since 2001. So we're talking about 14. This is going into our 14th year of war. So whatever good there was has been offset in a negative way, and I think far, far offset in a negative way. And, you know, originally, supposedly, we invaded Afghanistan because it was being used as a safe haven for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
But since that invasion time, it's been known by U.S. intelligence that there's very few al-Qaeda, if 100 or if that, or 200 maybe, in Afghanistan. And at the time of the invasion, there were a few Taliban, a few hundred Taliban. But now, I just read there's like 60,000 Taliban plus. And like I said, just a few al-Qaeda. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, why is that? Why is it that the indigenous people, and let's be clear about something. The Taliban are not some outside force that just came from somewhere. That's what al-Qaeda was. The Taliban are Afghans. So when the president and others say the Afghan people, but they don't include the Taliban, That's just disingenuous, and is said in that way to serve the purposes of coalition forces instead of educating, you know, our public that this is a civil war, and the U.S. basically is propping up a government that more than likely, if the U.S. leaves, will not be able to maintain power.
Oh, no, I think it's pretty obvious that the Taliban would take over in a matter of weeks if the United States wasn't there. But
And the thing about that is, from my perspective, you know, our supposedly one of the major principles of our own government is self-government and self-determination. And here we are, similar to the Brits that we had the revolution against, determining what kind of government that a nation has. And that totally goes against what we're supposed to stand for, you know, as the United States.
Now, of course, I shouldn't say of course. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there's not too much bad that could happen to the Taliban that shouldn't happen to them. I mean, astoundingly bad people, terrible people. I mean, you know, the worst kind of people that you could possibly imagine running anything. And their treatment of the Afghan people when they were in charge was horrendous, right? So I'm just saying that anybody with a good heart and a decent conscience wouldn't want these people there. And but things have gotten more complex, and they're really, in the end, it's time to admit that even though these people are, I don't use the word monsters, but these people are really, really awful, and that the Afghan people would be pretty. But for instance, if my second guest, you know, makes it today, she's the executive director of Women for Afghan Women. A very, you know, very wonderful organization and very brave organization. And they have set up, you know, schools and shelters for abused women. And as you mentioned earlier, that's one of the reasons why the United States, maybe a little good came in the United States because of the way women are traditionally treated there. But the Women for Afghan Women couldn't possibly exist without the U.S. forces there. So the thing does become sort of complicated, right? I mean, in the end, though, we really can't stay there. So, I mean, how do you deal with all that? One other thing I wanted to add so you can comment on it is there are people who say that there are other reasons why we're there, and that's inevitable, which is economic reasons. It could be the opium, which is because Afghanistan is a major supplier of opium in the world, and who knows who's making what money from that. Could be oil or gas pipelines and it could be rare earth minerals that are used. And the Chinese are, you know, right on the border there, and they're an expanding power, so it could be a strategic move. So I suppose there are other reasons. They certainly aren't any, they aren't doing any good for the average Afghan person, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, it's complicated, but at the same time, I think it isn't. And by that, I want to say that you cannot expand human rights. You cannot build civil society in the environment that's in Afghanistan right now. And I'm trying to remember the name of another women's organization there who, I can't remember their name, I think it's like WARE, stated that they have to deal with the Taliban, but they also have to deal with coalition forces. So it's not as if, you're right, the coalition forces create a somewhat of a safe zone for a number. Not, think about this. It's only, you know, around Kabul, for example, and a few other places. But across the country of Afghanistan, women aren't really any safer than they would be if the U.S. wasn't there, because the Taliban controls vast areas. And one of the problems with the way this war has progressed with the U.S. forces, coalition forces, haven't been responsible for killing a great number of people, at what point does, if my mother or my son, you know, my father dies from the Taliban forces or the U.S. forces, they're still dead. Mm-hmm. And you know, and how do I deal with that? And so you have where people are either scared to be in relationship with the coalition forces, or they actually have, which I think is why the Taliban has grown so much, they actually have a vendetta against the coalition forces. So if we were to pull our forces out and then put international pressure on the Taliban and try to open up, you know, the country, the influences in a nonviolent diplomatic way over time. We more than likely, I say we as in the world, not the United States, would be able to change the society to where human rights are respected more
well,
so. But that can't happen with the war the way that it is right now.
But isn't that just too idealistic? I mean, really, the idea of the Taliban, it's like ISIS, the idea of the Taliban working with any international group or working out their differences. I know you say that in your press release and you mean that. And maybe that's the only alternative to the United States being there. Because clearly, when the United States leaves, and we should leave, you get every last troop out of there. Otherwise, we'd have to stay there for the next 1,000 years. And that's ridiculous because it's not working anyhow. And look what happens, you know, sometimes with the way we're killing civilians. But once we leave, the Taliban, and if the Taliban takes over, or I should say when the Taliban takes over, how do you, nobody could deal with these people. Nobody was able to deal with them before. So isn't it more realistic to say we just can't help and we need to leave for our own purposes? And it's a sad thing what's going to happen to women, for instance, and to the entire society when the Taliban takes over again. But to deal with them, is that realistic at all?
Well, I would say that over the years that the United States has had relationships with a lot of bad actors. So it wouldn't be out of the ordinary to have a relationship with people who are not who don't have our values. I mean, Saudi Arabia isn't exactly a bastion of respect and human rights. And also, it takes a long time. It's not something that's going to happen in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or whatever. It might take 50 years, it might take 100 years, but you continue to engage and try to make that difference. But, you know, I don't know how idealistic it is when you compare it to what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe the idealism might be in the idea that you have to continue to engage when you're talking about people's human rights. But, you know, sometimes I look at our own country in the South. I'm a Southerner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of those Southerners, when you really think about it, were no different than the Taliban when it came. I'm African-American when it came to my people.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, through struggle, and part of it's going to have to be the Afghan women, and it's going to have to be good Afghan men who understand things need to change. So it can't just be only from the outside. Civil society in some ways is going to have to struggle and push back on the Taliban, and over time, because nothing stays the same, right? So 50 years, 60 years from now, things are going to change because that's what happens. Things can be better, but if we continue like we are now, the Taliban are not going to give up.
Mm-hmm. And it is, as you pointed out, it is their country. So,
right, it's their country. And when you look at Afghan history, no one has been able to go in there and control that nation. I don't know why, you know, we think all of a sudden the U.S. is going to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we have any other choice that really makes sense. And the reason we continue to do what we're doing now is because we're arrogant like we were in Vietnam. You know, we continue to think that we're special and that we can do something no one's ever been able to do. But the spirit of dissent and resistance that the Taliban have is not going to die down, and I don't think we can kill our way into changing that.
Well, all right. it's a sad, sad situation, and it seems to me the only answer for this country and for that country right now, as far as we're concerned, is that we have to pull out entirely. You've been listening to Michael McPherson, who's the executive director of Veterans for Peace, and why don't you give the website again, and people can go there and contact you and donate.
Yes, that's right. Thank you. And donate. VeteransForPeace.org, spell out Veterans for Peace, F-O-R for four. And I just wanted to ask people if they could look up a cost of war report by Watson Institute of Brown University, which is where I got in the statement that we wrote, where I got some of the numbers that talk about the casualties in Afghanistan and Pakistan, because when you talk about that area, you have to talk about the conflicts in both. And you will see that the United States has, and I'll say this along with the Taliban, it's not just the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
Have together been responsible for at least 29,900 civilian deaths And then when you look at indirect deaths, deaths because of, you know, disease and the infrastructure being destroyed and the lack of hospitals and things like that, you're talking about over 300,000 people. And so I wonder if that price is a very high price to pursue this ideal that, you know, we
right.
just finished talking about, when it could be done in a different way.
Well, I'm going to have to wrap up. So why don't you give the website again, and thanks
yeah.
thanks for coming on.
Sure. It's veteransforpeace.org, Veterans for Peace spelled out, F-O-R for four.
Okay, Michael McPherson, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. This is Mike Fader, and this is The Turning Point. We're going to have another interview coming up in just a couple of minutes. We're going to go to some music now, and then we'll be back. Okay, we're back. This is Mike Fader, and we have on the line, now, correct me if I pronounce this wrong, Maneja Naderi?
Yes, Maneja Naderi, you're right.
Maneja Naderi, okay. And she is in Kabul right now. We're speaking to her in Kabul, and she's the executive director of Women for Afghan Women, correct? And
yes.
Tell us about Women for Afghan Women. What is this organization?
Well, Women for Afghan Women is a women's human rights organization. We are the largest women's organization in Afghanistan. We operate in 13 provinces, and we run family guidance centers, which are legal aid centers, and women's shelters across the country.
So legal advice, legal aid, and shelter for women who, specifically women who what, have run away from abuse or are escaping from other kinds
of... Women who have experienced human rights violations, and that includes being beaten up by a family member or being tortured or running away from a forced marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, somebody who has been raped and whose family won't take them back, people like that.
So when was the organization first started?
The organization first started 6 months before 9/11 in 2001 with the intention of advocating for women's rights under the Taliban. At that time, the Taliban were in power. And then 6 months after that, 9/11 happened and everything changed. And then our mission became to make sure that women's rights were being included in all aspects of life in Afghanistan. We did a lot of advocacy.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So from 2001 until 2006, we mostly did a lot of advocacy both in the United States and in Afghanistan to make sure that women's voices were being heard across life in Afghanistan. And in 2003, when we went to Afghanistan to organize our third conference, we visited the women's prison, and at the women's prison, we saw that women who had no business being in prison, you know, women who were raped, girls who had run away from forced marriages were in prison because there were no shelters in the country to help them. So that's when our board decided that something really has to be done about that. And in 2006, we started our programs in the country, in Afghanistan. And then we started our shelters, mm-hmm. and we're in 15 provinces right now.
What's your background?
My background, I was born in Afghanistan, but my family left Afghanistan when the Soviets invaded, and I grew up in the United States. I was educated in the U.S. I live half of my time. I live in New York, and the other half in Afghanistan. That's my background.
So. Who's the staff? Who makes up the staff of these different places that you set up? I mean, it's a dangerous job, right?
Yeah, it's a very dangerous job. We have, in the country, we have a country director. We have province managers who manage the day-to-day activities of each province. And in the provinces where we have family guidance centers and shelters, we have lawyers on staff, we have caseworkers, psychologists, we have shelter case takers, we have teachers and guards and drivers and cooks, cleaners, that kind of thing.
So is everybody who staffs these places from Afghanistan, or are there some people from an international community there, or what?
Yeah, in the country, in Afghanistan, all of our 100% of our staff are Afghans,
mm-hmm.
local Afghans. We have an office in New York, where we also have a community center for Afghan immigrants, who mostly have the same issues as Afghans in Afghanistan. So we try to help them in our community center in New York. And in New York, we have Afghans and Americans mixed. We have a staff of about 9 people in New York.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had, or I suppose you have, but maybe now it's past tense, unfortunately, in Kunduz, when the Taliban reentered Kunduz,
yeah.
What happened with, you had a shelter there, right?
We had a family guidance center,
mm-hmm.
where we did counseling and mediation with the families, and our legal aid center there. We had a shelter in Kunduz. We also had a children's support center. Our children's support centers are for children whose mothers are in prison. And before we opened our children's support centers, children of all ages were in prison with their mothers because they didn't have family to go back to, or the families didn't accept them because they carry the stigma of the mother. So, our children's support centers are for children who are over the age of 5 and of school age. We've taken them out of prison. They're in our children's support center, getting an education, getting trained, getting counseling. They can be kids until their mothers come out of prison. So we had a children's support center there, too.
So what happened when the Taliban came back into Kunduz?
In Kunduz province, we have a staff of 64 people. And the Taliban, when they invaded Kunduz, it came out of nowhere. The day before the Taliban invaded, at 4:30, when everybody went home, everything was quiet. There was nothing unusual. Nobody even smelled that the Taliban would come. You know, mm-hmm. they had no idea. So they all went home. And at 2 a.m., the Taliban all of a sudden took over Kunduz, and they were fighting and shots being heard and screaming on the street. So at 2 a.m., our province manager realized that the Taliban had taken over. At that moment, she called the shelter supervisor and said, we had 13 women and 2 children in our Kunduz shelter. And she instructed the shelter supervisor to take the um, to take the women and bring them to the children's center so that the children and the women were in one place. This could be controlled better. Then mm-hmm. the supervisor did that. And then our province manager went to the children's support center and they waited for a couple of hours. And when it became, when the sun started to come out, they realized that the Taliban were in Kunduz and they were not going away. And the government didn't have the power to chase them away. So I'm glad that they were quick thinking on their feet. This all happened really fast and they really did the right thing. At that moment, they all got out of the children's support center and they walked. The women put on burqas mm-hmm. because we didn't want anybody to be recognized. So they walked to several of our staff members' houses because Taliban were going to be sure that they were going to come and attack the shelter or other offices. But the houses, we wanted to buy some time. Mm-hmm. So they were scattered among, five or six houses.
So is it,
and
so,
then,
so is it, so is everybody, yeah. is everybody from that facility safe right now? Everybody accounted for?
Yeah, we evacuated everybody.
Okay.
We evacuated everybody. Our province manager took the lead. There was a way out to go to another province. Our province manager, along with she has two little daughters, she took the lead and went in the first car. And then when she saw that the way was open and they weren't being attacked, she called the other staff and the women and the children who are in our children's support center. They followed in another car and they were all evacuated to Sakhar province and then to Kabul. So all staff and clients are all in Kabul right now.
Let me ask you this question. And I don't want to sound naive or provocative, but why? It's kind of a rhetorical question, but you could feel free to answer it any way you want. Why would you be afraid of the Taliban destroying your facility or harming anybody who was in it? What is there about the Taliban? Why would you be afraid of that?
Taliban are barbarians. They're against everything women. We for the past 2 years, we've been receiving threats from them. Mm-hmm. Our province manager has been getting threatening phone calls, threatening letters, telling her that they were, repeatedly she's been told they're going to decapitate her, they're going to kill her, they're going to kill her family, they're going to burn down the shelter. So we knew that because. Knew that they were going to come and destroy the shelter and maybe possibly kill our staff for doing the work that we're doing, because they're under the impression that doing women's rights or doing legal aid for women is against Islam, and we are following the laws of the infidels, and we're destroying the family structure, and we should all be executed.
Hmm. Well, this question then, here's a question which is sort of related to that. As far as the general society in Afghanistan, after all, you're Afghan, you were born there. As far as the general society goes, as far as the Afghan authorities who are not the Taliban, the military, the armed forces, or local governments, do you get much help from them? It's still part of a paternalistic society which doesn't really consider the rights of women very much.
Yeah, it is a patriarchal society, but Afghans, they want change. They're ready for change, and we've gotten a lot of support from the local government, from local police, the courts. Oh. We work with the police very closely. Whenever a woman runs away and goes to the police, they call us and they refer the woman to us so we can take care of her. In the past, we haven't really had any issues with police or the local government.
Now, there are a lot fewer American forces in the... I mean, you're familiar. We were talking earlier with another guest about the bombing of the Doctors Without Borders Hospital in Kunduz. And it's not the first time that United States forces have killed Afghan civilians. But from, you know, I mean, this is... And a lot of people would like the Americans to withdraw all of their forces. I mean, all of their forces. Seems to me, from what I can see, that the Taliban would take over the country in a matter of weeks if the U.S. forces withdrew. Could you operate at all in this country if the United States withdrew all its forces?
No, we couldn't. Afghanistan is not ready to take on, you know, the Taliban by itself. They might be ready in 5 or 10, you know, from 5 to 10 years from now. But right now, if the U.S. troops left, I'm pretty sure that the government is going to fall apart and the Taliban will take over. And it's going to be a very bad thing, not just for Afghanistan, but for the region as a whole, because it's not only the Taliban who are vying for power. It's ISIS, too. They're seen... several provinces, they're trying to come to Afghanistan and take over, like they did they took over parts of Iraq and Syria when the U.S. Troops left Iraq. So it's just going to be a bad thing for the whole world if the Taliban or ISIS took over.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Manisha Naderi, who is the executive director of an organization called Women for Afghan Women. And she's speaking to us live from Kabul in Afghanistan. Does your organization try to convince American citizens or even try to lobby politicians to keep the American forces in Afghanistan?
Absolutely. That's one of our mandates. Because we know, I mean, we work on the ground, we know what's going to happen, we know the country is going to fall apart, and we have been doing advocacy in Washington, D.C. with politicians, and we will still do it. We're trying to convince the American public that withdrawing from Afghanistan is the solution. Billions of dollars have been invested in Afghanistan, and thousands of American troops have died in this country, and it's going to be very sad if it's all in vain, if the troops leave prematurely.
Well, you know, there's a tremendous amount of pressure from other groups and from the general public in the United States and from a lot of people in Congress. There's a lot of pressure on people, on these people to withdraw American troops because they feel, I mean, you know, when something like this bombing of the hospital happens or... when they see the billions of dollars you mentioned being invested in the Afghan military and they see a lot of corruption in the Afghan government, they say that after, 13 years, that enough is enough. I'm just, you know, and I have to say that sometimes that's my opinion, too. But that's why I had you on to hear what your point of view is, because it's not so simple if we leave. Right.
Yeah. I mean, the government is corrupt. But we should remember that this is a country in its infancy stages. If you have, you know, if you will, because 13 years ago the Taliban were in power and Afghanistan had nothing. There were no infrastructure, there were no roads, no buildings, no civil society, no justice system. It was just tribal. Taliban justice, where if you stole something, your hand was going to be cut off. If you, if they suspected that you had sexual relations outside of marriage without any evidence, you would be shot on the street in front of people, or your head would be cut off. Or, you know, mm-hmm. This is barbarian law. That was 14 years ago. And, you know, since the U.S. came to Afghanistan, you can't even compare Afghanistan today to 2001. Everything has changed. We have a justice system that's growing. Yes, it needs help. It's not a perfect but it will become better once it has time to, you know, work out its kinks. We have we have an army, we have a police force, we have a growing economy. Everything, you know, everything's working, but it just needs time. You can expect. Think of it as a brand new country. You can't expect a brand new country to be perfect in 13 years. You know, you have to give it time and patience, and it will get better.
All right.
Afghanistan has a very young population, and, you know, we just need 10 years, about the maximum 10 more years for our young generation who's educated, who's progressive and open-minded, to become old enough to take over leadership positions, and then Afghanistan
will
be okay.
All right. We're just about out of time. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this, and I must say that I'm awed by your bravery, you know, by, you know, heading up this organization in the most hostile kind of circumstances. Manisha Naderi, who's the executive director of Women for Afghan Women, and what is the website if people want to go there and learn more about it and to donate money to your group?
It's womenforafghanwomen.org.
That's women plural. Womenforafghanwomen.org.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much for coming on, and good luck over there.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye. This is Mike Fader, and this has been The Turning Point. We're here every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern, and you can hear podcasts or the broadcasts, you know, later on that day, later on in the evening, and certainly the next day. This is the first time we've interviewed anybody on this show for a couple of years at least. And I felt that it was enough talk for me for a little while, and we might continue with more interviews. If you have any opinions about anything you heard today, please get in touch with me. The show runs on listeners. I mean, I can talk, but if nobody's listening, what's the point? So get in touch with me. It's and you can do that through the Fader Files, FederFiles.com. I would like to see the United States get out of there. But when you hear somebody like this woman and you hear what she's talking about on the ground there, then it makes you think twice. And the larger idea is, you know, do we belong in different places in the world with our idea of democracy and freedom and civil rights? Do we really mean it? Does it really turn out that way? Is it more trouble than it's worth? Are we doing more harm than good? These are not simple questions to answer, as you can see from what Manisha Naderi has just said. Okay, thanks. I'll talk to you next week.
fishermen.